Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 2nd of October, these are our main stories. Iran has launched a barrage of missiles into Israel. In a separate development, gunmen have shot dead six people in the Israeli city of Tel Aviv. Several others were seriously wounded. Mexico's first female president, Claudia Sheinbaum, has been sworn in. Also in this podcast...
Throughout the afternoon, ambulances relayed back and forth from the accident site, carrying the bodies retrieved from the blackened hull of the bus.
A school bus has crashed and caught fire just outside the Thai capital, Bangkok. We begin in the Middle East. Where Israel has countered a barrage of missiles fired from Iran. The weapons lit up the skies on Tuesday above Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and there were frequent explosions as they were shot down by Israel's aerial defence systems. Sirens sounded across the country at around 5:30 local time, and civilians were told to take refuge in bomb shelters. The BBC's John Donison spent the day with his team in Jerusalem.
Us, like millions of Israelis across the country, received a text message warning us to get to the shelters immediately. The sirens rang out. We ran for the safe room here in the BBC Bureau. This is an unprecedented Iranian attack on Israel on this scale, and the consequences could be huge. Israel was warned it was coming. But this was Iran's revenge. Almost 200 ballistic missiles raining in across the country.
Oh, God. Okay, guys, we got to get off the roof. These are coming down right next to us here.
As people ran for shelter, with the Iranian missiles traveling 2,000 kilometers in only around 12 minutes, Israel's defense system was at full stretch. The US said it helped in shooting down some of the missiles. Its intelligence agencies had alerted Israel to an imminent attack. But America says Iran gave no advance warning.
John Donison. Well, I spoke to a resident of Tel Aviv, Natalie Blenford, just after the Iranian missile attack.
There was an alert via an app that all citizens of Israel are supposed to have on their phones. And it said, stay near a protected space, which is a sort of euphemism for a bomb shelter. And I would say within 20 minutes of receiving that, a siren rang out. I'm in Tel Aviv. A siren rang out, which means sort of close up the bomb shelter, really stay there. And that rings for 90 seconds. And then I heard a series of explosions overhead. And this cycle repeated about three times, maybe four times. And we were in bomb shelters for 1 hour, hearing explosions overhead, whilst at the same time starting to get the news, if you were lucky enough to have Wi-Fi in your bomb shelter, of quite how big this attack was. And if I was to tell you that when I woke up this morning, I had no idea this would happen. You know, this is what we're dealing with. It was an absolute shock and very, very scary.
And where are you now?
I am still in my protected space, although I have opened up the door. I am in my apartment in Tel Aviv.
And what are the authorities saying? Because I know you've got these special apps on your phone that give you advice and tell you where to go and what to do.
Yeah, so after about 1 hour, we received a new alert which said you may leave the protected space. And so for now, we're sort of stood down.
Natalie Blenford in Tel Aviv. Well, the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, said Iran had made a big mistake and would pay a terrible price after Tehran launched the missile attack. In a video message, Mr. Netanyahu praised the country's defences and its people.
Tonight, Iran again attacked Israel with hundreds of missiles. This attack failed. It was thwarted thanks to Israel's air defense system, which is the most advanced in the world. I congratulate the Israel Defense Forces for its impressive achievement. It was also thwarted thanks to the vigilance and responsibility shown by you, the citizens of Israel.
Geeta Gurumurthy spoke on Tuesday to the BBC's Nick Beek, who's in northern Israel, close to the border with Lebanon.
I was just looking over my shoulder again because in the past 5 minutes or so, we've seen some explosions on the horizon. Lebanon is over there, so that is the border with that country, and there have been quite powerful explosions that have continued over the past few hours or so. In terms of what the Israelis have been saying about this Iranian attack that was carried out this evening, they said that it's something which has escalated things in the Middle East and have vowed that there will be a very strong response to it. Now, of course, critics of Israel over the past 2 weeks have said that the actions in intensifying the attack on Hezbollah has done the very same thing, has taken the Middle East to a new level of danger and of concern. But the Israelis are saying that there will be a response to this. All the while, people living here right in the north of the country, once again, were running to the shelters tonight, trying to take some sort of refuge amid the sirens that went off. And of course, that was a scene that was replicated across the country, with the Israelis saying that about 180 missiles were fired by Iran tonight.
And Nick, we're hearing that Joe Biden is saying that he will be speaking to Netanyahu and that they obviously, you know, we've heard from the US that they will be coordinating, of course, any response with Israel. Can you give us a sense of what Israel's potential options are for a response?
Well, certainly Israel has said that it's with the help of America in particular that they were able to thwart this Iranian attack, that they were able to shoot down many of these missiles. And in terms of casualties, nothing of a great level. And so the Israelis are saying this in itself is a success, and it's born out of that ironclad American support, as they describe it. So in terms of their options that come next, yes, America is saying vocally, and you're quoting President Biden in there, saying that it's absolutely behind Israel. But at the same time, the Americans have been saying over the past 2 weeks that they don't want to see an escalation. They don't want to see this go out of control. So there will be conversations in the background about what's going to happen. But I think what is really interesting is how the dynamic has changed here. We talk about what's happening militarily, but domestically, politically here in Israel, this has been a real boost for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. You remember over the past year or so, he's come under real pressure for his handling of the war, the fact that many of the hostages haven't been returned. But certainly this intensified attack against Hezbollah over the past 2 weeks or so, the assassination of the leader of the militant group is something that has played extremely well with Israelis here, not necessarily supporters of Benjamin Netanyahu politically. Talking to people here, they say that this has really boosted confidence in the country, but at the same time, people extremely mindful about what could come next, not least people who live in these sort of communities who normally would be living much further over towards the horizon there, but for the past year or so have been not able to live in their homes because of this daily exchange of fire, Hezbollah firing at these Israeli communities, and then, of course, Israel firing back. So this cycle of violence that continues, and I think tonight, after what has been undoubtedly a really significant night in the Middle East, in this latest conflict, people are very unsure about what comes next.
Nick Beek in northern Israel. Well, Israel has revealed that its forces have carried out cross-border operations in southern Lebanon for months. The military said it had destroyed tunnels and weapon stores belonging to the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah. The details were made public as Israeli soldiers carried out what were described as limited, localized raids a short distance inside Lebanon. Anna Foster is in Beirut.
It is all part of Israel's attempts to secure its northern border so tens of thousands of people can return to their homes there. But of course, on the Lebanese side as well, where Israel's been carrying out those airstrikes in the south to try and degrade Hezbollah's military capabilities there. And there have been many civilian casualties as well. Children have been killed. In the war in 2006, the death toll in 34 days was just over 1,000. And we've already reached and exceeded 1,000 here in less than 2 weeks.
Anna Foster in Lebanon. Tehran has warned of additional attacks if Israel retaliates. It said its response would be crushing and ruinous. President Joe Biden said the United States was fully supportive of Israel. He described Tehran's assault as defeated and ineffective. Speaking at the White House on Tuesday, here's the U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan.
Today, Iran launched nearly 200 ballistic missiles towards targets in Israel. The United States military coordinated closely with the Israeli Defense Forces to help defend Israel against this attack. U.S. naval destroyers joined Israeli air defense units in firing interceptors to shoot down inbound missiles. President Biden and Vice President Harris monitored the attack and the response from the White House Situation Room, joined in person and remotely by their national security team. We are still working with the IDF and the authorities in Israel to assess the impact of the attack. But at this time, and I stress at this time, we do not know of any deaths in Israel. We are tracking the reported death of a Palestinian civilian in Jericho in the West Bank. We do not know of any damage to aircraft or strategic military assets in Israel. In short, based on what we know at this point, this attack appears to have been defeated and ineffective. This was first and foremost the result of the professionalism of the IDF, but in no small part because of the skilled work of the U.S. military and meticulous joint planning in anticipation of the attack.
Our U.S. State Department correspondent Tom Bateman is in Washington.
Well, they're very concerned indeed. And when they've been asked repeatedly about what comes next, they are stalling on saying anything publicly on that, saying only that they are now consulting with their Israeli partners, as they put it, and that decision will be made. But I think it was fairly instructive that Jake Sullivan, the White House National Security Advisor, who made a brief statement when he was pushed on that question about the fact that before this, the Americans were saying that there would be severe consequences for Iran for a direct military attack on Israel. He was pushed on that point and said that they would now be discussing with their Israeli allies about what those consequences would be, and that there would be, he said, severe consequences. So we pretty much know where the Americans are at in terms of what they were warning of before all of this. I mean, I was one of among a number of reporters just now pressing the State Department spokesman Matthew Miller on all of this. His position was that they said that they had always tried to use a combination of deterrence and diplomacy to prevent this far wider escalation in the region, to prevent the war in Gaza engulfing the wider Middle East. Now, when I put it to him, would the Americans now be using both deterrence and diplomacy when it came to those conversations with the Israelis about what to do next with regards to Iran? He said, absolutely, it would still be both of those things. But it feels like the emphasis is very much on the deterrence element of that, i.e. the use of force, than it is on anything else. And remember that when the Iranians launched a ballistic missile and drone attack on Israel back in April, there was a sense, or it was pretty clear really, that both the White House and the State Department was urging caution to the Israelis. Some suggestions that, you know, Joe Biden had said take the win at that particular point for Israel, because that attack was precipitated by Israel's strike on an Iranian domestic diplomatic facility in Damascus that had happened previous to that. And we saw what was deemed to be really a restrained Israeli response after that one. So now what you're hearing is, you know, calls from within Israel for a much more forceful response than they gave last time. And it seems to me that at least in advance of this, the mood within the U.S. administration was that this time they wouldn't be reining in their Israeli allies. And that was very much the message they wanted to signal to the Iranians.
Tom Bateman in Washington. So, what is the mood in Iran regarding the Iranian attacks on Israel? I heard from our World Affairs correspondent, Caroline Hawley. I think the timing is very interesting because it comes a day after Benjamin Netanyahu addressed the people of Iran directly and said there's nowhere in the Middle East we can't reach. There's nowhere we won't go to protect our people. So Iran is clear that there will be a very, very strong Israeli response. So why is it doing it now? Well, we've had a statement from Iran's Revolutionary Guards. They're a very, very powerful force within Iran. And they said they launched these missiles after what they call a period of restraint. But they said they did it to retaliate for the killing of Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas leader who was assassinated at the end of July. That was obviously a major humiliation for Iran. It happened in Tehran. And Iran at that time said it would respond. There would be a response. And no response came. And in this case, when Hassan Nasrallah was assassinated, the supreme leader seemed to suggest that he would leave Hezbollah to respond. And now we have this. What we understand is that there has been a big debate and lots of divisions within the Iranian establishment over how to respond, with moderates saying, it's not the time. There is a relatively moderate Iranian president who was elected earlier this year. But the conservatives and the hardliners have clearly won out. And an Iranian official has told Reuters that the missile launches were ordered by the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei himself, which is interesting because he's been seen as a cautious man. And I think what Iran has done tonight has shocked and surprised many people watching.
Caroline Hawley. Meanwhile, in a separate development in Tel Aviv, six people have been killed in a shooting attack. At least nine others were injured, several of them seriously. Police say the attack happened near a light rail station in the Jaffa area of the city. Israeli media say the two assailants, who were seen getting off a commuter train, were shot dead by a passerby and a security guard. Surveillance camera footage showed one of the attackers armed with an assault rifle. The motive for the attack is unknown. And staying with the Middle East.
Hello, I'm Jackie Leonard, and we'll be recording a special episode of the Global News podcast to mark 1 year since Hamas attacked Israel from Gaza. We'll be putting your questions to our correspondents who've been covering the Middle East for the past 12 months. Please send us your questions, ideally a voice note by email, to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Thank you.
Thanks, Jackie. Jackie Leonard. Still to come.
Leonardo runs a small shop in the community of La Siesta de Tocumen. His store used to sell fresh chicken and pork, but there's no mains piped water here.
Panama is one of the wettest countries in the world, but it's unable to provide all the water its population needs.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
One of his HR team approached me and said, the chairman would like you to work in his office.
It was pretty quick that my gut instinct started to go, this is not right.
The only thing that he was interested in was touching my body.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
In Mexico. Those were the scenes of the Mexican Congress in Mexico City on Tuesday as Claudia Sheinbaum was sworn in as the country's first female president.
Honorable Congreso de la Unión.
Congress of the Union, people of Mexico. I promise to keep and uphold the political constitution of the United Mexican States and the laws that emanate therefrom, and to perform loyally and patriotically the office of President of the Republic that the people have conferred upon me.
Claudia Sheinbaum says she plans to continue the social programs of her predecessor, President López Obrador, which polls show are hugely popular in Mexico. I spoke to our correspondent Will Grant, who's in Mexico City.
a real moment of celebration. She has now received the presidential sash. She's now Mexico's first woman president in history. And, of course, the first thing she did was to set out her political agenda. In it, it struck me that it felt very much like a blueprint based on the previous 6 years. She was quick to thank her political mentor, the outgoing president Andrés Manuel López Obrador, celebrate his achievements in terms of pulling millions of Mexicans from poverty, which is something that has been done. Upward from 8 million Mexicans have been pulled from poverty during his time in office, and said she planned to focus on healthcare and creating another 300,000 places in higher education in Mexico. So all of that, of course, is positive and music to the ears, if you like, of those people just below me in the Zócalo, the main square in Mexico City, waiting to catch a glimpse of Claudia Sheinbaum as president.
So a lot of celebration going on now, but what are the challenges she faces in Mexico? Because there are many, aren't there?
There are. I mean, this is a very, very complex country, both politically, economically, and of course in security terms. So let's start with that last one. The fighting in states like Sinaloa and Chiapas has worsened significantly in recent months, particularly after the arrest and double cross of a high-profile drug trafficker, El Mayo Zambada. That's created a very, very deep and bitter split within the Sinaloa cartel, and there are gunfights in the streets of the capital of Sinaloa, Culiacan. That is going to be a challenge for any leader, but it's one of the first things that will greet Claudia Sheinbaum in her inbox. Beyond that, of course, the economy of a country of 130 million people is an extremely difficult thing to manage, particularly when the debt burden, for example, on the state-run energy company is so high. She'll have to find out who her neighbour is. Will she be working with a second Donald Trump presidency, or will she be working alongside another woman in power in Kamala Harris? All of that's still to be seen, but I think, as we've mentioned, it's all going to be for another day in terms of her supporters who are simply celebrating her win.
Will Grant in Mexico. As we record this podcast, the two US vice presidential candidates are gearing up for their first and only TV debate against each other. Republican Senator J.D. Vance and Tim Walz, a Democratic governor, go head-to-head in New York, with just over a month until American voters head to the polls. More now from our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
Both of these men were specifically chosen to appeal to mainly white working-class voters in the Midwest and Rust Belt. But they have very different styles and different political visions. J.D. Vance paints a dark picture of a country in crisis with a failing economy, rising crime and immigration out of control. Tim Walz sounds much more optimistic about the future, although he has not been afraid to go on the offensive, often acting as the attack dog for Kamala Harris. Mr. Vance has very humble origins, but he's also a slick Ivy League lawyer, who will probably be asked about some of his more controversial comments about childless women. While Mr. Walz is a much more folksy character who was a high school teacher and football coach, he may well be attacked for being too liberal on issues like transgender rights. Vice presidential debates are not often seen as particularly significant moments, but this election appears to be so close that winning over even a few voters in some of the key swing states is important to both campaigns.
Sarah Smith. Emergency workers in Thailand have recovered 23 bodies from a school bus which crashed and caught fire just outside the capital, Bangkok. The bus was carrying dozens of children on a field trip. 19 pupils and three teachers are reported to have survived. Our correspondent Jonathan Head sent us this report from the scene of the accident.
Throughout the afternoon, ambulances relayed back and forth from the accident site, carrying the bodies retrieved from the blackened hull of the bus. 16 of the survivors were taken to hospital to have their injuries treated. Witnesses say the bus, which was carrying 38 schoolchildren and six teachers, crashed into the concrete barrier dividing the highway just north of Bangkok after a front tyre burst. The bus was quickly consumed by an intense fire, and many on board were unable to get out. The cause of the fire is still unknown. The bus was otherwise not badly damaged. The authorities are promising a thorough inquiry, but Thailand has seen similar accidents many times before, where the woefully inadequate standard of both the vehicles and the driving were found to be the cause. Yet successive governments have done almost nothing to to address this country's appalling road safety record.
Jonathan Head. Panama is one of the wettest countries in the world and has a canal which earns it billions of dollars a year. So you'd think it would be straightforward to provide all the water its population of 4 million people needs. But many don't have access to piped water, and the canal authority is still dealing with the effects of a drought, which lost it hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue following ship crossings being reduced. One solution is to create a new reservoir, but that would mean thousands of people losing their homes and their land. Bob Howard has this report.
Leonardo runs a small shop in the community of La Siesta de Tocumen, just outside Panama City and down the road from its international airport. His store used to sell fresh chicken and pork, but there's no mains piped water here. So Leonardo had to close his butchers and open a little general store instead.
Well, I have to stop selling chicken and pork because I didn't have enough water. Without it, I couldn't sell meat because good hygiene requires you to have water. So I have to close down the business.
In one of the wettest countries in the world, Leonardo, like hundreds of thousands of Panamanians, relies on tankers coming to supply him with water. In the rainy season, the water is here, but the government has failed to invest in a comprehensive mains piped system, which would supply everybody in the country. And with the population growing, things are getting worse, and the water tankers are not always reliable.
It arrives in tankers every 3 or 4 days. Before, it took up to 15 days for the water to arrive here. The government keeps saying it would solve it, but we are still waiting.
The state water company that supplies most households says it has never had the budget from the government to supply everybody with piped mains water. But it is investing $20 million to help bring it to 3 communities, totaling 60,000 people. It estimates it will need $800 million to connect everybody. But climate change means even in a place as wet as Panama, there may not always be enough water to supply the 4 million plus population and work the canal's massive locks. Each ship which traverses the canal uses an astonishing 50 million gallons of water as the locks raise it up and then lower it down as it crosses from the Pacific to the Atlantic and vice versa. Last year, there was a drought, and the canal had to reduce its traffic on some days by a third, losing the country hundreds of millions of dollars. One solution is the building of a new lake to store water in the basin of the Rio Indio. The problem? At least 2,000 people will have to be relocated, and some don't trust the canal authority to do right by them. Oligario Cedeño is a community leader in the Rio Indio area.
What they have told us is that we are going to be relocated to other properties like the ones we have, which is impossible because we all have very different properties. Since they announced the building of the reservoir, they've shown us no respect for our land, just total contempt.
The canal authority, however, insists that a growing population, a sustained demand by shipping companies to use the canal, and climate change means new solutions must be found. Ilia Espino de Marotta is the deputy administrator of the Panama Canal Authority.
The water usage for canal operations has been very, very efficient, but we do have a very increased population. So as time change and things evolve, you need to adapt to new situations.
Ilia Espino de Marotta, deputy administrator of the Panama Canal Authority, ending that report from Bob Howard. Let's return now to our main news and top story, Iran's missile attack on Israel and Israel's warning that it will respond. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, and our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, have been discussing the situation. First, to Lise.
I think what everyone is asking tonight is what happens next. I was in April when Iran fired what is now said to have been more than 400 ballistic missiles and suicide drones into Israel. That was telegraphed. The Arab foreign ministers were told about the attack about 72 hours before. The Americans knew. The Israelis were prepared. Very few of them landed. Most of them were brought down by mostly by the United States, but also by Britain and by Jordan. Jordan said it was to protect its own citizens. And then Israel used the phrase then that it is using tonight. We will respond in a place and a time of our choosing. But last time, and Frank and I discussed this many times over, is it was basically just a symbolic strike, almost like they left their calling card very strategically placed right in the center of Iran, by Isfahan, close to a nuclear reactor. And basically as if to say, we know where you are. We can get you, and we will be back. This time will not be a calling card. They are talking about severe consequences. Benny Gantz, what he said, Netanyahu's political rival, now they're all talking the same language. He said, it is either us or them, and the mission is clear. Whoever attacks will be attacked and will be hurt. Israel will respond in a way which makes it absolutely clear that it will simply not tolerate this. We talked a lot in April about each side wanting to establish deterrence. In other words, to say that we have hit you, and if you hit me again, I will hit you back. I don't know about you, Frank, but I think just the deterrence, especially for Iran, what happened with Hezbollah, their forward advance, their deterrence is heavily dented. And Israel now is in a risk-taking mood after its spectacular military successes of the past few weeks. And it does seem, with every day, it seems clear they've decided this is the moment to strike. And we are going to strike hard everywhere. We've long, and for in Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's case, wanted to attack for decades.
I think the gloves are coming off. I totally agree. The last time, in April, there was a concerted international diplomatic effort to put a restraining hand on Israel. So after they had this volley of 300 drones and missiles lobbed at them, all of which, nearly all of which, were intercepted, nevertheless, Israel wanted to hit back hard. And the international community, particularly the US, said, please don't, because, you know, Iran will then hit back at you and there will be a regional war. So as Lee said, it was a symbolic hit. This time, the gloves, I think, will be coming off. I've been looking at some of the comments by former Israeli intelligence officers who've been publishing them online, saying Israel is likely to respond soon and with much greater force.
What does gloves coming off? What does hitting hard mean? What does it look like?
OK, so...
Yeah, well, I mean, the big, big question, and I'm sure it's being discussed in situation rooms in many capitals now, Israel has long wanted to make a preemptive strike against Iran's nuclear facilities. I mean, that would be the bomb of all bombs. That would be the one they want. I don't think they would want to do that, but they will want to do something big.
I mean, OK, Iran's nuclear facilities are buried very, very deep beneath places like Parchin, and Natanz is easier to get, but a lot of these facilities are deep inside mountains. I think they will quite possibly want to hit the launch sites that launch these missiles. Israeli intelligence is pretty good. So we are in a very dangerous place right now where both sides are saying, well, if you do that, we're going to do this. So we've got to react, and there will be fallout casualties of this, of people who are neither Israel nor Iran.
Whatever happens in conflicts, there is the facts on the ground, and the facts are that none of them, except for, sadly, a man in Jericho who was killed. It's the perception of who has won that's really going to matter. And these videos of some of the missiles having an impact, not hitting a target, but having an impact, not being shot down by Israel's much vaunted Iron Dome and others, is going to allow Iran to say, see, look at this. We've been able to penetrate Israel's air defenses. So everyone will have their own videos to be able to say that they won this round.
Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, and our security correspondent, Frank Gardner. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
One of his HR team approached me and said, the chairman would like you to work in his office.
It was pretty quick that my gut instinct started to go, this is not right.
The only thing that he was interested in was touching my body.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.